This is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF. Ahead on our program, Governor Asa Hutchinson says he has a plan for funding highways he thinks Arkansans can afford. John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat-Gazette, says he thinks that plan will gain legislative approval, but might have flaws. And the Arkansas Democrats say they have a tax cut proposal they say is beneficial to more Arkansans than the one their counterparts across the aisle are promoting. It's all ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. After this afternoon's Ozarks on NPR's Here and Now, on his new album Birdman, drummer Antonio Sanchez explores the immigration debate and his own displacement as a Mexican-born American citizen. Here and Now begins this afternoon at 1 on 91.3. If a rainy winter has you thinking about a vegetable garden, the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks is ready to help. Tonight at 6:30, the BGO will host a session called Vegetable Gardening for Beginners. BGO's horticulture supervisor Megan Langford will discuss the basics. The event is free for BGO members, $15 for non-members, and it's scheduled to last from 6:30 to 7:30 tonight. Governor Asa Hutchinson's plan for paying for highways is now known. The governor outlined a $300 million plan yesterday, the largest in state history. $300 million that would be collected through a mix of taxes, fees, and casino-related income. The governor says he settled on a $300 million total because he thinks that's what Arkansans can afford to pay.
Whenever we set a spending program, someone has to pay for it. And what guides me is the worker in a rural part of Arkansas that must drive 30 miles to work and back every day in their vehicle and put gas in the car. What guides my thinking is that farmer that has to get his products to market and is driving on a difficult road that's not properly maintained.
The governor says he sought to create a plan that he says would balance affordability but also still allow for the ability to pay for maintaining existing roads as well as new construction. The $300 million plan includes slightly more than two-thirds, about $205 million, derived from an extension of a current half-cent sales tax dedicated to highway bonds. That tax is scheduled to end in 2022, but the governor's plan would seek voter approval to make the half-cent sales tax permanent.
The $205 million, the extension of the half-cent sales tax, would need to be referred to the voters by an amendment through this session, and they would be voted on in November 2020, and that would give it time to set in motion before the existing program expires.
The other $95 million would come from a variety of sources. A fee tacked to the purchase of electric cars would provide just under $2 million a year. The governor says drivers of electric cars won't be paying into highway funds at the gas pump, but still using the roads, so a new fee assessed on electric cars would help make up the difference. The governor says another $58 million each year would come from a new index on gasoline and diesel,
which would be equivalent to a 3-cent raise in the gasoline tax and would be a 6-cent increase in the diesel tax, and that would net out for the state $58 million. Now, let me emphasize, if you're concerned about that word index, the indexing is limited to 0.1 cents per year. And so, but that would allow it to be a 3 cents and 6 cents as we enact that.
The electric car fees and the index tied to the gas pump prices would both require legislative approval. The final $35 million projected to pay for roads would come from a casino-specific tax. In November, Arkansas voters approved an amendment for the possible construction of new casinos, though at least one of those possible casinos in Pope County is meeting strong resistance.
And the $35 million would be dedicated state casino tax revenues and the utilization of other funding from our general revenue to guarantee $35 million per year going into this highway plan.
The governor admits the casino element is a bit unpredictable, but he's confident the $35 million can be reached. He says the state currently receives just over $31 million annually from gambling. He says he expects that money to continue to flow into the state's general revenue, and he expects the total to reach $35 million with casino gambling growth.
In the short years, we'll make sure and guarantee that it's $35 million a year. And so that's a guarantee from our restricted reserve fund, as well as whatever other sources we need to make sure that that commitment is made.
And under the proposal, counties and cities would receive $114 million a year for roads. The governor's plan requires a mix of legislative and voter approval. John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, thinks ultimately the proposal has a very good chance of becoming reality. This week's conversation between John Brummett and Roby Brock with our partner Talk Business and Politics examines aspects of the highway funding plan revealed yesterday. Roby asked John Brummett if legislators have any downside approving a gasoline tax this session.
Yes, but not much, probably. I think you're just going to get to the usual liberal whining, which I'm good at and which I can now engage in, but it's just a fact. In this same session, let's be clear, the governor, after I just praised his vision, and I do praise his vision, but his particulars, this is what he's doing. He is proceeding to, and I think he'll get all this probably done, reduce income taxes, taking $97 million from the general fund, $76 million of which will go to people making $456,000 a year. Okay, he's going to take $76 million out of the general fund and give it to people making $456,000 a year. Meantime, he and the legislature are going to raise what you pay at the pump per gallon on your motor fuel if you're a working man trying to get down the road to get to work. That is a shift of a tax burden that I believe is unfair. I think there are not enough of us in Arkansas who care or get worked up about that to cause any problem.
It does make it a user-oriented fee, though, versus...
Well, that's the issue of fairness, that you pay it according to your use, to which I say, you know, the ones who have to use it are the ones who have to get out and go to work and pay their own costs of transportation and those sorts of things. But it only takes a majority vote. And as I understand it, and all this is iffy, the governor just had his deal and we haven't got all the particulars.
This is called a hot take, John.
I know that. Yep. But I think, not, in addition to these 3 and 6, that's the initial, and after that, this will be indexed, mm-hmm. which other states have done, so that as the cost of materials or as costs, I don't know how it'd be indexed, or cost of highways go up, you have a cap. Relatively small annual index, which would make it flexible, which has always been a good idea. So that's, and it's also, this asked the legislature, before they defer the decision to the voters, to step up and take one decision yourself, yeah. vote on this. Yeah. So I think that's...
Which I think there's some courage there to do that. I've heard it from several of them there. Registration fees for alternative vehicles, not going to raise a tremendous amount of money, but as electric cars perhaps become more prevalent and steal money away from not consuming gasoline, right. this is an area of potential growth.
Right now, on the graph that the governor had, the little gray strip, I think it was, for the electric car tax was so small I didn't see it. it was, and as you see... But yeah, this is what he's trying to do. And may I go ahead and say the other part is
go
a casino
ahead,
tax.
Casinos,
put that
yes.
because these go together.
Yes, go ahead.
He wants to. It's $300 over $200 million of which the voters would vote for themselves the constitutional amendment. It's $65 from the motor fuel tax that the legislature would vote. $35, $39, something like that would be tax on alternative electric cars. And new casino take to the state, because casino revenue now goes into the general fund. And he's saying we're getting these new casinos going to be coming up online. We're going to get in these expansions at Southland and Oaklawn. And even though the state's take is going to decrease by rate, the increased activity will create more money. All of that is iffy.
Yeah, a little bit predicated on some assumptions.
Right.
Yeah.
But it is, one, it relies on, he would argue, general revenue, which he hasn't wanted to do before, only in the context of new revenue. Mm-hmm. He's saying, you know, yeah, we're tapping some general revenue, I guess if you want to say that, because this money's from the general revenue, but it's the stuff that's going to come from these new kinds of cars and these new casinos. So it's not going to take from the teachers, it's not going to take from the schools. It's going to take from general revenue. Mm-hmm. And that if there is increase in those sums, if there is, and that's debatable about what happens from the casinos, it would otherwise go to schools and general needs. So he is taking from general revenue at a time he's also taken $97 million out of it for income tax for the well-to-do. So there are all sorts of issues and column. There's column fodder there for me. But as a program, as stepping up to the responsibility, it's got a legislative element, it's got a public element, and he does sort of use general revenue, but I'll give him credit, he's found a way to use it.
In the most careful of ways as he could.
In a careful way, so long as he's right that this casino thing comes out in the wash with more money for the state. Yeah. If it doesn't, he's taking it straight out of existing
general
revenue.
It will come out with more money eventually. Maybe not in year one or year two, but eventually you will see a big uptick in those
special
revenues.
You think people are going to be going to these casinos?
Well, yeah, and there's going to be more of them online. Right. So, I mean, you're for sure going to get one in Pine Bluff. Russellville,
we've got
maybe
you. The one in, if we're counting on the one in Russellville, it's not certain.
But
yet.
The two in Hot Springs and West Memphis.
Long term, long game, we're going to have more casino activity in the state. Yeah. All right.
All right. Last question to you on the subject. Does any part of this not pass? Well, or does the whole thing, you think it will be successful? Go ahead and predict it now.
I think it'll all pass. I think the three-fourths vote is tough. I mean, and I'm still... The idea of the income tax cut getting through three-fourths, they can't have many Republican defections. They're going to get that done, but right now that's trouble. But this plan, a 50% vote plus one on the motor fuel tax index, yeah. The general revenue, oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The rest is left to the voters. And the last time the voters had a chance to vote on this very same thing, they overwhelmingly approved it, even as I predicted that they wouldn't. So I thought they were anti-tax. They're anti-tax unless it's for highways, apparently. So the odds are they'll pass that. So in the end, we'll get it all.
John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and his columns can also be found at ArkansasOnline.com. He spoke with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics. And you can follow legislative news at talkbusiness.net. About an hour before Governor Asa Hutchinson offered details yesterday regarding his highway plan, Arkansas Democrats offered a counter to a different proposal the governor made earlier this session. That was his call for a tax cut of $97 million, much of that for the state's highest tax bracket. Yesterday, House Minority Leader Charles Blake and State Representative Tippi McCullough held a press conference outlining the minority party's tax plan. That proposal would trim about $73 million of the governor's plan, which has already passed in the Senate, and institute a 10% earned income credit that Democrats say would benefit about 300,000 Arkansas households. State Representative Tippi McCullough says her party has been contemplating a tax package of its own for a while.
It's something I think that we've been thinking about for a long time. Our concern with the governor's plan, and we aren't against the governor, and we're not even trying to work against him, but we're trying to help make his plan better and make it better for Arkansans. And ours is different in that instead of focusing on that top 1%, we're trying to work on people that that we feel like need the money more the middle class section of our population. Instead of his plan, 76% of it focuses on helping individuals who make more than $456,000 a year. We just don't think that makes sense. We feel like that the people that need the help are the 300,000 working families of Arkansas that this earned income tax credit could actually help.
Why? I know that you and Representative Blake say that this will stimulate the economy more, this sort of proposal. Why do you say that?
Yeah, well, economic history tells us that. State level, it's real tax relief. It'll help 32,000 veterans, 143,000 rural families, 173,000 young workers, and anyone else in that category that makes under that much money. It's going to help a married family with three kids that make up to $54,000 a year, or a single mother of one that earns up to $40,000 a year. These are people we should actually be giving the tax relief to. It's proven that for when you put that money back into working families' pockets, then that money comes back out as an economic gain for all of our communities. I'm looking around. I believe it's, I can't remember, but I know it's for every dollar. It's like, you know, $1.50 to $2. I think it ends up almost being $3 that goes back into the economy.
You know, someone might be hearing our conversation say, well, wait a second. The governor's plan, if you look at over years, has there's already been a tax cut for one spectrum, a tax cut for another spectrum. There hasn't been yet a tax cut for the wealthiest or the highest earners in Arkansas. What's wrong with doing that?
Yeah, and I understand that point. But we still, as advocates for the working families that are here in Arkansas, we still believe that they are the ones that benefit the most from this plan. I know growing up, there were lots of times that my mother had to figure out where she was going to get money, whether it was for my basketball shoes that she had to buy when I was in high school, or once I got into college, even though I was on a basketball scholarship, I was at a private college. Wichita Baptist, and they paid fees and tuition, and she had to find money for my dorm rooms and for my meals and everything. So this is money that's going to help people that actually need it. It's going to put more than this other tax bill that's going through right now, the governor's tax bill. It's going to put more money into their pockets, which, once again, we haven't seen any real proof yet that lowering it from 6.9 or to 5.9, we haven't seen the proof that that's going to be a big boon for corporations coming into our state, like they say it has. And when we ask for proof, we're not seeing that yet, except for simply that we can say we have a lower tax rate than surrounding states. Once again, we're just advocating for all of these families. When we can advocate for 300,000 people instead of the small amount, the 14,000 that's actually going to benefit from this, we just think that's common sense.
Debbie McCullough is a Democratic state representative from Little Rock who joined the House Minority Leader Charles Blake yesterday to announce a Democratic Party tax plan. The governor's plan has been approved by the state Senate, now is in the state House, where it will require a 3/4 approval. This is Ozarks at Large.
When you brush your teeth in the morning, you're not just brushing for fresh breath today. You're also protecting your teeth so they're healthy tomorrow, right? It's the same idea with Morning Edition. When you tune in, we don't just give you the news you need to make it through today. We also give you the news you'll need tomorrow and beyond. Take the long view with us. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday from NPR News.
Morning Edition every weekday morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3. And each weekday morning, we keep you up to date with news and information from around the region with Antoinette Grajeda's newscast. And if this week already seems long, don't fret. Tomorrow on our show, Timothy Dennis declares us weekend ready with his rundown of live music around the River Valley in Northwest Arkansas. That's on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on 91.3. And ahead on this Tuesday edition of Ozarks, the Militant Grammarian is back with some obscure winter terms.
What common flu symptom do you think these words refer to?
Okay.
Kiffle, Hosk, Boke, Tisic, and Kinkhoust.
More creative ways to explain that you are coughing and sneezing your way through February. Our Militant Grammarian is ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large.
The Delta Dental of Arkansas Foundation presents Toothapalooza, celebrating National Children's Dental Health Month, at the Scott Family Amazium in Bentonville, Saturday, February 23rd, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. The first 500 children and their families will receive free museum admission, dental screenings on site, and oral health supplies. More information available on Delta Dental of Arkansas's Facebook page. KUAF and Walton Arts Center are giving away two tickets to the February 26th opening night performance of the Broadway production, A Bronx Tale. Registration is available online at KUAF.com. The winner will be announced Friday, February 22nd, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. KUAF.com for information.
And on this edition of Ozarks at Large, we end our series of conversations previewing University of Arkansas Honors College Signature Seminars That will take place in the fall. Our last preview brings a pair of scholars to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, Padma Viswanathan, Associate Professor of English at the University of Arkansas, and Justin Barnum, a visiting assistant professor in the U of A's Department of Sociology and Criminology. Combined, they will lead a seminar titled She Done It, a seminar that will explore female criminality. The course will draw on history and literature. Padma says she was inspired to create the seminar as she worked on a nonfiction book about a friend whose stepmother was a bank robber in Canada in the 1950s. That work led Padma to investigate how her subject was treated in the Canadian justice system and more. And Padma says she wanted to make sure that when she led the seminar, she did it with someone from sociology. Justin says it's important to note that while he is a sociologist, he's not a criminologist.
Although criminology kind of grows out of sociology, there's definitely some major distinctions between us. So in terms of thinking about crime, you know, from a sociology perspective, we're thinking about, well, how do we define crime? And the definition of crime is always related to power. Who's in charge? Who's defining the laws? Who's deciding what is and is not appropriate? And all of this is growing out of this kind of establishment of the norms of society and deviance within society. And there's some really interesting ways that we can think about crime, and we can go all the way back with women in crime to think about like the witch trunts in the early colonial days and think about, well, some interesting research shows that regardless of what the acts were being committed by women that were kind of criminalized as witches, there was kind of a steady percentage of women that were always kind of identified as criminals, as witches. And so we kind of see this development that it's not so much about the crime so much, it's about making sure that when we can label someone, when we can identify that these people are bad, that these people are not law-abiding citizens, that then we can say, well, on the flip side of that, that means that we're good citizens, that we're good people, that these things kind of work off of each other. And so there's kind of this necessity that kind of is kind of tracked in terms of needing deviance, of needing criminality just for the rest of society to be able to say that we're not criminals. So I think that's always important to think about in terms of who is a criminal and how is criminality defined. It's always in relation to kind of the norms of society, but also the norms as being defined by the people in power. So thinking about like a upper middle class kind of morals and virtues and how that gets translated into a legal system.
Will you examine whether if or whether men and women who are seen as criminals are treated differently by society?
It will definitely be one among many topics. One thing that struck me, one of the writers I was reading in the context of my book talked about how women criminals tend to be punished twice. Once for breaking the law, and secondly for having transgressed the idea of female virtue, right? That men are expected in some way to be aggressive, and certainly the vast majority of incarcerated individuals are men. Now, why is that? Because all of our behavior in some way is gendered, and criminality is as well, both on the part of the perpetrator and on the part of societal response to it, which, you know, as Justin just said, our legal system embodies. So, yes, definitely my subject, for example, she committed this robbery in the company of two men. One was her husband. The other was a younger man who, it transpired, was her lover. And then her husband turned up 2 months after the robbery. He had gone from Vancouver, where the robbery happened, to Edmonton to hide out, start a new life. It's not really clear. And then he turned up dead in a ditch of a bullet wound. And the ways that Mary Lloyd, my subject, was portrayed in relation to these two crimes. The murder was never solved, although her young lover was tried for it. But she was, by some people, portrayed as like a feminist journalist who helped her a lot and wrote about her. Some said that she was used by the men in her life. She could have been a great lady, but she was used by the men in her life. But the justice who delivered the acquittal of that young man in the murder trial said, I have no doubt that you did this. Everybody here believes that you did this. We just can't prove it. And I believe you did it at the urging of Mary Lloyd. Now, if you're going to continue to be influenced by her, things will not go well for you. So you have these two very radically different portrayals, both, again, I would say, very gendered. A younger man led astray by this manipulating older woman versus a woman being used by the men in her life. In neither case is she sort of acting on her own volition, right? In both cases, she's defined relationally. And I think that's a huge part of what we see in the differential treatment of men and women criminals.
And I think that's kind of an interesting thing to think about sociologically, because when we're thinking about differences between men and women and kind of how they commit crimes differently or are perceived differently as criminals, we know that women actually kind of are seen by society, by men, and even by themselves as defining themselves in relationship to men, right, as mothers, as significant others. And so kind of thinking about when we're thinking about these double standards that we have in society, we can think of these ideas of how gender is actually one of the things that determines how we define a crime.
You'll use fact and literature in this seminar series?
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's one of the things that we're really figuring out now is how we marry our two disciplines in the course of deciding which texts we'll be looking at. But certainly it's going to be a balance of literary texts representing criminals, which could be fictional or nonfictional. Both are equally interesting, definitely one or two films in there as well, along with various texts that I think Justin is better equipped to talk about.
Yeah, just, you know, being able to bring in kind of the statistical data that's, you know, the evidence that's been accumulated, whether that's by, you know, state, local, national government agencies, but also kind of thinking about, well, how do we talk about these things? And then thinking about even the data that we're collecting on women criminals, who's collecting that data? And so there's a lot of very, what's presented kind of as fact, but may not be as factual in terms of, is the question that's collecting that data, is it actually the question that should be asked?
I think there's also going to be a very interesting tension, I might say, between the sociological theories that Justin will likely bring in and matters of craft and literary technique that our students will also necessarily need to wrestle with, right? Any of us as individuals, we're subject to societal pressures, right? We respond to these things, that we respond to expectations, we've internalized these expectations. But in literature, we're often presenting some kind of distillation of those ideas, and there are pressures to make a story compelling, right? Much of crime writing, we think of it as being quite sensationalistic, necessarily not trying accurately to represent social forces in a complex way. But I do think there are also arguments for the ways that literature can do that. And so hopefully between these sort of frameworks that each of our disciplines brings, students will sort of deconstruct it, falling out both ways, right? How do we tell a story better, taking structural matters into account? How do we achieve certain kinds of accuracy by looking more at the individual versus the societal, right? How do we parse those things?
Yeah, because I imagine a challenge is to not make it too sensational, because I have to admit, the moment you mentioned I'm writing this book about a woman bank robber, boom, I was like, oh, tell me more. This is fascinating. I mean, that's just the criminal element. Is it salacious to begin with?
Mm-hmm. And I think this is kind of where the sociological aspect comes in some more, is kind of really understanding, well, what are those questions for the why, the how, the kind of those things that influence this person to do these things? What are those kinds of environmental, situational kinds of things that kind of frame something, but also present a certain path that maybe, you know, in a certain situation, a woman has no choice but to act in a certain way, or at least she feels she has no choice but to act in a certain way. And I think that's kind of one of the beauties of kind of using sociology to talk about this, is to kind of go back to kind of a pretty common concept in sociology, which is the sociological imagination, which is coined by C. Wright Mills, 1959. He talks about how can you kind of understand that all of us are kind of trapped by society, that we're all kinds of within certain environments where we're kind of limited by the things that are moving around us, whether it's our race, our class, our gender, our access to education and opportunity. And so thinking about, you know, getting students to really think about, what is it like to be in the shoes of these women that might have committed these crimes? And then how do I kind of position myself in such a way that I can then write about them or write as them, depending on what the case may be, whether they're real actual people or whether they're these fictional characters that might be developed.
I think also to sort of triangulate between what Justin was saying and what you're saying, there's some aspect of deep curiosity in both these cases, right? Thinking of the criminal as very different from us and sort of intriguing and evil and transgressive, and thinking of the criminal as similar to us in, you know, responding to desire, to social pressures, to necessity, right, to boundaries. And the one very interesting aspect for me in trying to write this story is acknowledging how compelling the fact of this female criminal is. And the story itself is very dramatic, irresistibly dramatic. I mean, I've only given you kind of the, you know, the first few developments in it. And yet I also have this urge to contextualize, right? I want to tell the story so that this momentum is not dampened, so the curiosity of the reader is answered, at the same time as I don't want to feel that I have answered that at the expense of the sociological imagination, making her seem alien, you know, putting her in some very distant space. Rather, I think the force of literature that I most admire is the literature that makes you identify with somebody who otherwise you wouldn't think you would have a lot in common with.
Have you determined whether there'll be any other noteworthy real-life figures that will be discussed?
Not specifically. We're kind of thinking about which types of crime to include, and then I think that's going to determine which figures will come out, whether that's in fiction or in actual life experiences. So,
because I'm just wondering about Patty Hearst. I mean,
her name has arisen.
Yeah, because there's so many things involved with
that. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Patty Hearst, exactly, from this question of a young woman possibly brainwashed or manipulated to this question of, say, with her, the women involved in the Baader-Meinhof gang or others who considered themselves to be, you know, political activists doing criminal activities, Assata Shakur, who has ended up in Cuba, Black Panther. Justin brought to my attention a number of very interesting cases where women would perform acts that they, you know, in some ways they had no choice but to perform, but that were defined as criminal, sometimes defined as criminal at the time, and then later no longer, because our laws shift to reflect societal expectations. You know, Bonnie Parker has come up. She has a local tie-in as well, right? Justin mentioned Lorena Bobbitt the other day, right? There have been a number of individual cases. Another thing that we were talking about just yesterday was how some famous cases end up becoming, end up having literary works written about them. Others don't. And what is there about a certain story which may be very intriguing and sensationalistic, but which doesn't loan itself to literary retelling as opposed to others that do for whatever reason, which could be some gesture toward myth-making, or it could be that some things are too dire to be talked about. I'm not sure, but that is something else that we might end up investigating.
Padma Viswanathan is an associate professor of English at the University of Arkansas and an author. And Justin Barnum is a visiting assistant professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminology. Together, they will lead a U of A Honors College signature seminar next fall called She Done It. They'll also deliver a free public preview lecture next week, Tuesday, February 19th at 5:15 in Gearhart Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. That preview lecture will also be streamed on the U of A Honors College Facebook Live page.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today we're in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio with Nina Evans. She's Program Manager with Feed Communities. Nina, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you for having me.
How long have you been with this group?
I've been with Feed Communities since April of last year.
Okay. What is the goal? What's the drive of Feed Communities?
Absolutely. So Feed Communities was founded in 2011 with the mission to alleviate hunger and create sustainable food networks for our community. So we just work to do that day in and day out and get people the access they need to the healthy food and just create a healthy community for all of us.
What I like about you guys, too, it seems whenever I would see feed communities or hear feed communities, it was also closely tied to some other community nonprofit who might be trying to do something. Y'all really do all work together, and that's really what it's all about, I guess. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. We've got to build that community.
A newer program, I think, that we're going to talk about in depth here, a diabetes prevention program.
Yep, so this is just kind of our holistic approach to well-being. You know, we do a lot with the community gardens, a lot with the food outreach, so now we're kind of circling back around to health. Currently, it's the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, estimates that more than 1 in 3 Americans are pre-diabetic, and 90% of those don't know it. So this is a rising epidemic, and pre-diabetes will greatly increase your risk of having type 2 diabetes.
Gotcha.
So we're trying to catch people who are pre-diabetic and give them life skills and kind of coach them through to develop healthy habits to prevent that onset of type 2 diabetes. We're going to tie this program in, too, with our community gardens a bit to kind of give people that hands-on feel and just show them how easy it can be to make those options available.
Nice. You know, somebody wants to know more, find out a little more about the program. Maybe they can be part of it. What's the best thing to do?
So they can call us at our office. Okay. That number is 479-966-4790. They can swing by our office. We're at 221 South Locust, which is pretty close to the library here.
Okay.
Or they can email me, which that is nevins@feedcommunities.org. We have Facebook, Instagram, and we have a website. So those are all other options to reach us as well.
Nina Evans, Program Manager with Feed Communities. That diabetes prevention program might be something you want to look into. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
It's the Community Spotlight. Remember, if something cool in your neighborhood is taking place, let me know. My email is pete@kuaf.com.
It is time for another visit with our militant grammarian, one of my favorite times of the week. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Catherine Sherlitz. Yes.
Thank you.
What do you got?
Well, I would say that I have a topic perfect for this blustery winter day, but because we're recording this, there's no telling what the weather is today.
That's right.
After all, we're in Arkansas.
Right.
But thanks to our old friends Mental Floss, mm-hmm. we have a list of obscure words for winter woes.
Okay.
So let's get one of the most disgusting words out of the way first.
All right.
Kyle, you know how sometimes, especially in cold weather, you'll feel something tickling your nose, uh-huh. and then you see a droplet fall.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, for teachers who often bend over students' papers, that can be really scary.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, that pendulous droplet on the tip of a person's nose has a name.
I'm going to say it's a mucolet.
Oh, I like that.
Oh, thank you.
It's a meldrop.
Ooh, that's better. That's better.
Derived from Scandinavian roots, originally a meldrop was a drop of foam from a horse's mouth around the bit, mm-hmm. that metal crossbar that's in the horse's mouth. The 16th century Scots extended the meaning to describe a drip of water from the tip of an icicle, mm-hmm. as well as from one's nose.
It would be fitting that it starts in Scandinavia, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they've got a long time
trip
to think
Bahamas
about this.
Is not likely
exactly.
to come up with that.
Exactly.
True. A long-forgotten dialect word for the nose or for the metal hoop pierced through a bull's nostril is snarl.
Okay.
Then in the 18th century, the word meant a stuffy head cold.
A snarl.
I like that.
I do, too.
Yeah, because, you know, when you feel, when you got it, you feel snarly, don't you?
Yeah, so far, 2 for 2. Meldrop and snarl are on point.
All right, now a guessing game for you, Kyle.
Okay.
What common flu symptom do you think these words refer to?
Okay.
Kiffle, hosk, boak, tisic, and kinkhost.
Coughing.
You got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's got that hark kind of word sound to it. To kiffle is to cough because you have a tickle in the throat.
Okay.
To hosk, as you might imagine, is to cough harshly or painfully. To boak is also to cough violently. A tisic is a dry, tickling cough. And a kinkhost, according to 19th century vocabulary of East Anglia, referred to a combined violent cold and cough.
This all sounds like Snow White's medically challenged seven dwarfs here. Kiffle, hosk, boak.
And here's another one. A fox's cough. is a hoarse, scratching cough that refuses to clear up, apparently so called because a fox's call is so raucous and guttural.
Yeah.
And finally, one to stay away from is the churchyard cough.
Ooh, that's going to put you underground.
You've heard that.
Oh, yes, I have.
Oh.
It seems like I read it in, like, Victorian literature.
This is a 17th century term for a bad cough, seemingly indicative of impending death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're a goner. The latest medical advice these days says to cough like a vampire, right?
Yeah, you cough into the inside elbow.
Yes. This also applies to what other symptom?
Sneezing.
Yeah. Or if you're sick in the 16th century, the sneeze was called a sternutament. Sternutament. I have no idea how it's pronounced because there was no guide. It's sternutament. Sternutament.
And that's what we would call the vampire?
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Well, it's a sneeze.
Oh, I got just you. A sneeze. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh. Sneeze is so much better than that.
Right. As with the cough, for sneezing, the dictionary has quite a rich vocabulary to fall on, at least the archaic dictionary. Chisop. Atisha.
That sounds like that's onomatopoeic right there. It sounds like a sneeze.
Well, it also sounds like for what you need when you sneeze.
Oh,
a tissue.
Yeah. Like you're asking for it.
That's right. You sneeze and you're asking at the same time.
Right.
Neasel. That's I love that one. That really sounds like it. And the adjective ptarmic, the first letter of which is a silent P, describes anything that makes you sneeze.
So pepper would be a ptarmic.
Yeah. For me, dust is a ptarmic.
Yeah.
Even the word sneeze itself is of interest, as it was originally spelled F-N-E-S-E.
Oh, you're making that up.
No.
What?
Before its initial F was misread as a long S in the 15th century. You remember how see all those Fs everywhere in that old stuff?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, there are some
really S's. Yeah.
Works of literature that I just put back on the shelf and said, I'm not doing that. Yeah.
Okay, Kyle, what do you think the word headwark refers to?
A headache?
Yeah.
Fever?
Yeah.
Headache.
Yeah, headache and pain, actually.
Okay.
Old English word. and then more formally is cephalalgy.
Hmm.
A word for a headache coined in the early 1600s.
Oh, that sounds serious. Cephalalgy sounds like
something you don't want
to have.
That you're headed for a courthouse cough.
Exactly.
Courtyard cough.
Courtyard cough.
Should be courthouse, I guess. I think it's bound to be the origin of the over-the-counter cold symptom treatment called Cepacol, that the spelling is very much alike. And for the really serious headache, Gallia. A Latin word for helmet, which, according to one 1706 dictionary, refers to a headache because it takes in the whole head.
Okay.
So it's a really bad
headache. I appreciate
that. Well, with all these symptoms, you're probably feeling at least a little offish.
Peaked? Weak?
Not exactly unwell,
okay. But
you're not feeling your best.
What, in my household, we say less than 100%.
Yeah.
Just something's a little off.
But just, not quite.
I can still go to work.
Yeah,
I'm just feeling
exactly.
Awkwish? Offish?
Yeah.
Offish?
Right.
Okay.
Awvish.
Awvish.
A-W-V-I-S-H.
All right.
Probably derived from the use of ish to mean not quite. If you're awvish, then you're not exactly unwell, but you're not feeling your best.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, from the 18th century, you might be feeling frobly-mobly or fobly-mobly. I want you to come in some day and say, I'm here, but I'm feeling frobly-mobly.
I have to prepone my meeting because I'm frobly-mobly.
Exactly. The lexicographer Francis Gross defined the meeting as indifferently well in his glossary of provincial and local words in 1839.
Frobly-mobly.
Frobly-mobly. And if you're only feeling offish and really not that unwell, you might practice presenteeism.
Presenteeism?
What do you think that means?
Presenteeism?
What would be the opposite of it?
Pasteism?
No, not present. Not
okay.
Present as in here. I'm here.
Absentism?
Yes. It's the opposite of absenteeism.
Is presenteeism.
Yes.
There are two kinds of people in the world right now. Those who are like you and me right now, Catherine, who are like just overjoyed that they've discovered this. And everybody else, it's like, what the heck are they talking about?
Okay. It's a term coined in the early 1930s, pretty recent, mm-hmm. for the act of turning up to work despite being unwell.
I love that. So we don't like absenteeism that much, but we don't really like presenteeism
either. No, because it's going to spread around.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
This is great.
Do not practice absenteeism nor presenteeism.
Right. Well, practice absenteeism if you're sick.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Right.
You might decide going to work is better than allyism, mm-hmm. an obscure term from psychology and psychiatry. The restless boredom or ennui that comes from being unwell and confined to your bed.
Yes.
And you can only watch so many Andy Griffith reruns.
That's right. And yes, absolutely.
I think we'll quit now, Kyle. All this talk is making me a bit ovish.
Right. Catherine Sherald is our militant grammarian. Tomorrow, on a Wednesday edition of Ozarks at Large, a Catholic high school in northwest Arkansas was a dream for many people for a long time. Now, a little more than a semester in, we check in on the Ozark Catholic Academy in Taneytown. That's on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF. Also tomorrow, an update on a proposal for redesigning Highway 71B in Fayetteville. And Timothy Dennis gives us a rundown of the live music we can expect to hear throughout northwest Arkansas and western Arkansas through the weekend. And don't forget, if you can't be with us at noon or 7 on 91.3 KUAF for Ozarks at Large, you can find us at ozarksatlarge.com. There we have past full editions of our program. We have individual stories. We have individual interviews that you might have missed or you might want to share with folks. And you can do that by using the links that we provide at ozarksatlarge.com. And also, we're available as a free podcast through services like iTunes and Stitcher.
Walton Arts Center's 10x10 Art Series presents Michael Andrew with the Fayetteville Jazz Collective, Saturday, February 23rd at 8 p.m. This former singer and band leader at the Rainbow Room atop Rockefeller Center in New York City will pay tribute to writers of the American Songbook, including Johnny Mercer, the Gershwins, and Frank Sinatra. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets. The University of Arkansas has students that represent every county in the state. U of A graduates live, work, and contribute not only in our area, but in communities throughout Arkansas. The University of Arkansas, dedicated to serving the state since 1871.
This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. Thanks to Timothy Dennis for mastering our show again for us today. Thanks to Antoinette Grajeda for her help on the show as well. Our conversation between Roby Brock and John Brummett was recorded inside the KATV studios in Little Rock, and that conversation comes to us almost every week through our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can learn more at talkbusiness.net. The Community Spotlight is produced by Pete Hartman inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at KUAF. Our militant grammarian is Catherine Sherald. She joins us most weeks. And Antoinette Grajeda curates the end of show music that we play many days, including today. Don't forget, we will be back tomorrow at noon and 7 with a brand new daily edition of Ozarks at Large. Now, about the music at the end of today's show, we selected a song recorded exclusively for us at the Carver Center for Public Radio by the band Arkansas. The song is titled Every House Downtown. We bring up Arkansas because you've got a chance to see them in downtown Fort Smith on Friday night. They will be at Harry's Downtown, beginning at 9:30. And if you don't see them at Harry's downtown in Fort Smith, you're going to have to travel a little bit to see them through early March. Now, you could see them Saturday night at King's Live Music in Conway. After that, it's Kearney, Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska, Concordia, Kansas, Fremont, Nebraska, Tulsa, Norman, Oklahoma, and Medicine Park, Oklahoma. To see their full schedule and when they will be back, if you can't see them at Harry's downtown this weekend, you can go to their website, ArkansasMusic.com. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for spending part of your Tuesday with us. We always count it a big privilege when you spend time with us. This is Arkansas and the song Every House Downtown.
One, two,
thanks for
three,
listening.
Leave on out, live in every house.